This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
he wanted to set an example for Germans by telling them, even I, you know, a famous pastor who was known for resisting and defying Hitler, who was in a concentration camp for 8 years, even I didn't do what I was supposed to do, and I'm admitting to it. So it certainly is a confession. He's confessing that when they came for the communists, trade unions, socialists, and Jews, he did not speak out. So I think of it as a confession. The poetic aspect of it, it's possible, came later, and perhaps even from his supporters and champions, because up to this date, no one has really located a moment when Martin Niemöller actually said it in this poetic fashion.
Many are familiar with Martin Niemöller's famous statement that first they came for the communists, then they came for the trade unionists, then they came for the Jews, and then they came for me and there was no one left to speak for me. Not as well known is the life that Martin Niemöller led. He fought alongside right-wing paramilitary groups in Germany, and he was an ardent supporter of Adolf Hitler until he ended up in a concentration camp himself. Today we'll be in conversation about the life of Martin Niemöller. Our guest is Matthew Hakanos. He is the author of the book, Then They Came For Me, Martin Niemöller, the Pastor Who Defied the Nazis. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. A team of investigators entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul for what Turkish officials called a joint inspection of the building where Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi disappeared nearly 2 weeks ago. The makeup of the investigative team that entered the diplomatic compound was not immediately clear. It also wasn't clear what evidence, if any, would remain nearly 2 weeks after Khashoggi's disappearance. President Trump told reporters he spoke with the Saudi king this morning, who very strongly denied involvement in Khashoggi's disappearance or killing.
We are going to leave nothing uncovered. With that being said, the king firmly denied any knowledge of it. He didn't really know. Maybe, I don't want to get into his mind, but it sounded to me like maybe these could have been rogue killers. Who knows? We're going to try getting to the bottom of it very soon, but his was a flat denial.
Turkish officials have said they fear a Saudi hit team that flew into and out of Turkey last week killed and dismembered Khashoggi. He had written Washington Post columns critical of Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The kingdom has called such allegations baseless, but has not offered any evidence for their contention that Khashoggi left the consulate. President Trump and wife Melania are visiting Florida and Georgia to view damage caused by Hurricane Michael. The death toll stands at 18, but officials believe it will rise. Up to 36 people are still unaccounted for. The coastal town of Mexico Beach was virtually destroyed. Michael came ashore the Florida panhandle as a Category 4 hurricane with 155-mile-per-hour winds. It was supercharged by warm Gulf waters. The battle over affirmative action is being waged in a federal court in Massachusetts. The case claims Harvard's affirmative action policies discriminate against Asian American students. Civil rights groups call the lawsuit an outright attack on affirmative action. Christopher Martinez reports.
Affirmative action will be on trial in a federal court in Boston with a challenge by a conservative group against Harvard admissions policies that they say discriminate against qualified Asian American students. The lawsuit, Students for Fair Admissions, Inc. versus Harvard, claims Harvard's affirmative action shuts out qualified Asian American students, much in the way Jewish students were blocked by Ivy League quotas earlier in the 20th century. Many civil rights groups disagree. Nicole Ochi is supervising attorney with the group Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Los Angeles.
Asian Americans will not benefit from the elimination of affirmative action, and that Ed Blum is just trying to use Asian Americans as a cover for his true agenda of changing policies that will ultimately benefit white students who already have the most advantages in the admissions process and in life.
The lawsuit is being brought by a group founded by Edward Blum. He's a conservative legal activist who brought an earlier lawsuit against affirmative action at the University of Texas in 2016, a case that failed, as well as another Supreme Court case in 2013 that overturned parts of the Voting Rights Act. I'm Christopher Martinez.
Today's the last day to submit comments on a Trump administration proposal that civil rights advocates call a protest tax. The National Parks Service has proposed rules that would require payment for a permit to hold a rally on Park Service property. That includes common areas such as the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The proposal would also severely restrict the size of the protest area in front of the White House. Demonstration organizers already have to pay for associated costs such as porta potties, emergency medics, the stage, and sound for rallies. But civil rights groups say the new proposals are so onerous they would be beyond the reach of many grassroots protests. And that may be precisely the point as demonstrations have multiplied. The National Park Service is accepting comments online at regulations.gov. The Trump administration is considering using West Coast military bases or other federal properties as transit points for shipments of U.S. coal and liquefied natural gas to Asia. The proposal amounts to an end run around West Coast officials who have rejected efforts to ship coal. A DNA analysis done on Senator Elizabeth Warren provides strong evidence she has Native American heritage. That's according to the Boston Globe, which published the Massachusetts Democrats' test results. Donald Trump has repeatedly mocked her claim of Native American blood, calling her Pocahontas. Native American groups have denounced Trump's remarks as a racial slur. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. I suspect many of us are familiar with this famous statement from German priest Martin Niemöller just after the end of World War II. Quote, "First they came for the communist and I did not speak out because I was not a communist. Then they came for the trade unionist and I did not speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews and I did not speak out because I was not a Jew. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak for me." Again, I suspect many of us are familiar with those words from Martin Niemöller. What I did not know until very recently was how extraordinary the life of Martin Niemöller was, from being a supporter of the rise of the Nazi Party to being Hitler's prisoner, including a stay in a Nazi concentration camp. So today we are going to be in conversation about the life and times of Martin Niemöller. My guest is Matthew D. Huckiness. He is the Harriet Johnson Todvin 56th Professor of 20th Century History at Skidmore College, and he is the author of a biography. It's called Then They Came for Me, Martin Niemöller, the Pastor Who Defied the Nazis. Matthew Huckiness, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Tell me about the formation of those words. You even begin your book on this when Martin Niemöller and his wife were visiting a concentration camp.
Yeah, so Martin Niemöller survived the Nazi period, obviously, and he had spent time in two concentration camps, Sachsenhausen, which is a concentration camp outside Berlin, and Dachau, which is a concentration camp down the south outside Munich. And so in the fall of 1945, his wife, Elsa Niemöller, and him were traveling around Germany, and they were down near Dachau, and his wife asked if she could visit the camp where he stayed for 3 or 4 years and to visit his cell. So Niemöller got in contact with the Americans who were now in charge of the camp, and they allowed him to show his wife the cell that he had stayed in. And then they also went to visit the crematoria that existed at Dachau. The crematoria were never used to kill prisoners at Dachau, but they were there for the potential of that purpose. And outside the crematoria, there was a plaque affixed to a tree that said how many of the prisoners had been killed during the life of the camp. And the camp lasted from 1933, very early, of course, until 1945. And Niemöller read this inscription along with his wife, and they were both really moved by the number of people who were killed. But Niemöller was sort of taken aback by the fact that it read 1933 to 1945 and not some later date, like, say, 1937 or 1939 to 45. And the reason why I was taken aback by it was because he was a free man from 1933 until 1937 when he was arrested by the Nazis. And so he had sort of a revelation at that moment that he, just like many other Germans, was guilty or held some level of responsibility for what happened to the people during those years, that is the socialists, the communists, the trade unionists, and the Jews, what happened to them during the years 1933 until 1937 when he was arrested. This moment at the Dachau concentration camp took place in November of 1945. And it was really from that moment on that he went on a sort of a speaking tour around Germany, trying to convince his fellow Germans that they could not turn their back on the past and pretend that they had nothing to do with it, that they needed to take some sort of responsibility for it. And during these speeches, he began to become more and more concrete, saying, you know, when the Nazis came for these different groups, I was silent. And he begins to use different groups in the confession. And he sometimes mentioned communists, sometimes trade unionists, socialists, the incurably ill, Jehovah Witnesses, and then, of course, Jews. And this is really the origin then of the famous confession. We can sort of date it as late 1945, early 1946.
Is that what we call that statement, a confession? Is it a poem? How do you describe it?
It's interesting because if you look at his sermons and speeches from 1946, you don't see anything like the poetic confession that you read out loud at the beginning of the show. Niemöller would be giving a sermon or a talk to Germans, and he would want to use his own example. He wanted to set an example for Germans by telling them, even I, you know, a famous pastor who was known for resisting and defying Hitler, who was in a concentration camp for 8 years, even I didn't do what I was supposed to do, and I'm admitting to it. So it certainly is a confession. He's confessing that when they came to the communists, trade unionists, socialists, and Jews, he did not speak out. So I think of it as a confession. The poetic aspect of it, it's possible, came later and perhaps even from his supporters and champions, because up to this date, no one has really located a moment when Martin Niemöller actually said it in this poetic fashion.
That's interesting. Looking at the statement and looking at the order of it, first they came for the communists and they came for the trade unionists, then they came for the Jews, then they came from me. When you look at German history and a history that he was a part of it, that's no insignificant order. That's kind of how it happened, isn't it?
It is. Certainly in January, you know, Hitler was appointed chancellor by President Paul von Hindenburg on January 30th, 1933. And almost immediately, the Nazi movement made up of the stormtroopers, the SA, took it upon themselves to arrest and incarcerate the political left. So they really did start with communists, socialists, and trade unionists. Fortunately, perhaps for the Nazis, somebody burned down the parliament, the Reichstag, in late February 1933, so only a few weeks after Hitler was appointed chancellor. And that gave Hitler and the Nazis the sort of authorization, came from President Paul von Hindenburg, to begin the arrest of communist socialists and Jews, since it was a communist who had been blamed for burning down the Reichstag. So from that point on, it was kind of a free-for-all for the Nazis. Jews were sort of caught up in this, primarily because obviously the Nazis were anti-Semitic, but also because a number of the Jews were associated with liberalism or the left. So perhaps it'd be fair to say that the early arrests of Jews had more to do with politics, but clearly anti-Semitism played a huge role in that as well.
Let's get into the biography of Martin Niemöller, because it is just right in line with this historic trend that we see happening in Germany from really World War One through World War Two. He was born in 1892. He was born during a very different time in German history, during the Kaisers. He'd live a very long life, Martin Niemöller would, but really the first half of his life, I guess, can very much be described as him being on the far right of the political spectrum. Tell me the importance of growing up during a period of time of the Kaisers.
Yeah, so Martin Niemöller's life is fascinating. He lives 92 years. He lives through several sort of major political transformations in Germany. And so his first part of his life until 1918, he was living under the Hohenzollern monarchy. That's the Prussian monarchy that ruled Germany from 1871 until 1918. And in 1888, the Kaiser was Wilhelm II, and Wilhelm was a staunch nationalist, a Protestant, and he believed very much in nation as well as empire building. He really sought to create an empire that could challenge the British Empire. And so Wilhelm II was a big fan of growing the military. And in particular, he wanted Germany to develop a top-notch navy. And so from early on in his period as the Kaiser, he put a lot of money and effort into building the navy. And Martin Niemöller was very much a person who supported and championed the politics of Wilhelm II. Martin Niemöller's father, Heinrich, was a Protestant pastor in a very small town in Westphalia. And so one might have thought that Martin Niemöller would also follow in his father's footsteps and become a pastor. He does do that later, but his first love was for the Navy. And so after graduating from high school, he went to naval cadet school for 3 or 4 years. And then World War I broke out in 1914, and Niemöller served in the Navy from 1914 to 1918. He served on 4 different U-boats, the 4th U-boat, U-67, he was the commander of, and he was awarded an Iron Cross in 1917. He was an absolute ardent supporter of the Kaiser, of Germany's efforts in the war. And he was obviously extremely disappointed when Germany lost the war and the Kaiser was overthrown in 1918.
Yeah, and World War I and the aftermath of World War I and how in Germany people on the right felt about how that war came to an end and who was responsible for the end of World War I is very important, including in the rise of what we'd see with the Nazis. And I want to talk about that. But before we get there, tell me more about the religious background of Martin Niemöller and perhaps the importance of Protestantism and Martin Luther. This is, even though Martin Luther existed some 400 years earlier and had the Reformation, this is a very important story in understanding the background of somebody like Martin Niemöller and religion and the far right in Germany.
Yeah, well, because Martin Luther was being persecuted by the Catholic Church, the Prussian princes at the time, well, the German princes, came to his defense. And so for much of the 400 years of Lutheran history leading up to Niemöller's time, the Lutheran Church had been a very, very strong proponent of the state. We often talk about the marriage of throne and altar in the Protestant Church. So the Protestant Church was extremely nationalistic and felt very much that it owed its allegiance to the state. And the state bestowed certain sort of privileges on Protestants and, you know, mostly the people who led the various ministries and obviously the Kaisers themselves were Protestant. And Martin Niemöller was brought up in a very conservative Protestant household. His father was a champion of the Hohenzollern monarchy, and he instilled this in his two boys, Martin and Wilhelm. Both of them ended up serving in World War I proudly, and then after the war, both of them took up their father's career and became pastors.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about Martin Luther and the Reformation, and Martin Luther in some ways was a very radical figure of his time. He broke off from the power of the day, the Catholic Church. But that said, his views towards civic life was very different, because even the work of Martin Luther would cause other revolts to happen, including the peasant revolt. But he never supported those other things that dealt more with politics and civic life. Martin Luther was always a firm believer in top down, I guess, type of rule.
Yeah, there are also, you know, other sort of Protestant churches within Germany that are kind of relevant here. The Lutheran church is obviously the strongest and the largest in Germany, but Martin Niemöller lived in Prussia, and although Prussian is very Lutheran, they had something called the United Church, which combined some administrative qualities of Calvinism and Lutheranism, and there was also a small Reformed movement or Calvinist movement in Germany as well. And certainly the Lutherans sort of dominated the Protestant church, and their nationalism and their love for the fatherland and their commitment to Germany expanding its power across the globe was a very central component of German Protestantism during the Second Empire or the period of the Kaisers.
And this is key in understanding people's worldview at the time, especially from the right in Germany just after World War One. And then after World War One, in the defeat of Germany, people like Martin Niemöller are just absolutely destroyed by the loss. Not only was Martin Niemöller destroyed, so was, and upset about it, so was Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, so The First World War, most people went off to the war fairly enthusiastic, although not everyone did. Obviously, a lot of workers and socialists would not have been as enthusiastic as, say, the middle class about going off to war in 1914. But a lot of Germans believed that the war would be short, that they would achieve an easy victory. You know, they were going to employ the Schlieffen Plan and take out France quickly and then turn on Russia. But it didn't go that way, as we know. The war was incredibly deadly, both on the home front and the battlefront, and it lasted four horrible years. And when it came to an end, Germany was on the losing side. It lost on the battlefield. It had simply run out of men and ammunition. They could no longer sustain the war effort. Even though Russia had been knocked out of the war in 1917 and the Germans were able to transfer the vast majority of their troops to the Western Front, they still couldn't defeat the French and the British. And the addition of the Americans in 1917 and 1918 just overwhelmed the Germans. So when the war came to an end, Germans were sort of shocked. No one really had been warned that it was going in this direction. The leaders of the war, Paul von Hindenburg and Erich Ludendorff, had not been honest with the population, and they had insisted that they could win the war. And it was right up until sort of the last minute that Germany believed that they had a chance. And so the war came as quite a, the end of the war, the loss came as quite a shock to a lot of Germans. Niemöller was just devastated by it. The end of the war was accompanied by a socialist revolution. This spread throughout Germany and overthrew the Hohenzollern monarchy. Wilhelm II was forced to flee to Holland, and a moderate liberal socialist government came to power. These were, Niemöller and the Protestant Church's enemies.
Blamed them for the loss of the war.
Yeah, the far right in Germany established this idea that Germany had been stabbed in the back at home by socialists, communists, and Jews, and that they, in fact, hadn't really lost on the battlefront. In part, they sustained that by arguing that very few battles or foreign troops were on German soil. The Germans had defeated the Russians on the Eastern Front, and they still occupied territory in Belgium and France at the end of the war. And so they could argue inaccurately, but they could argue that, we didn't really lose the war on the battlefront. We were stabbed in the back by these internationalists, atheists, and Jews on the home front.
This is the Weimar Republic?
Yes. So the Weimar Republic comes to power in 1918 with the fall of the monarchy, and it remains in power until 1933 when Hitler comes to power. It starts off as a sort of liberal, socialist-oriented government, but over time it moves to the right, and by the end of the Republic, there are a lot of right-wing conservative nationalists who are dominating the government.
During this period of time, especially after World War One, but really leading up all the way to the rise and the final takeover of government by the Nazis in 1933, it's just a wild political scene that turns oftentimes violent throughout Germany. This is a period of time when we see the rise of the Spartacus League and people like Rosa Luxemburg on the left, and Munich, you had the rise of Kurt Eisner and the Democratic Socialists, who they were actually overthrown by communists, who were overthrown by other communists after that, because that's how the left usually operates, I guess, until where in Munich and Bavaria is where you get the rise actually of the Nazis originally. But you see these pitched battles in the street between the left and the right during this period of time. Is Martin Niemöller involved in that at all?
Well, he returns his submarine. When the war was ending, was in the Mediterranean, or was in the Adriatic, and he had to sail it through the Mediterranean, through the Atlantic, back to the ports in northern Germany. And when he arrived there, the socialist revolution was already underway. There were different factions, as you pointed out, in the revolution. There were socialists and there were communists. And he was not directly involved in any of those pitched battles at that time. He had returned home. His fiancée was at home in near where he grew up in Westphalia. So he returned there for a little while. He was disgusted with what was happening, obviously. He felt that Germany was just falling apart. His first plan actually was to move to Argentina and become a sheep farmer, because a lot of sort of right-wing naval commanders were doing that. They just could not stand living in Germany under a new government. He decides not to do that, and eventually takes up farming himself in Westphalia. It's during this time that the communist movement in Germany is trying to influence and overthrow the socialist government, and Niemöller leads a brigade of sort of Free Corps. These are demobilized soldiers who maintain their weapons, and they become sort of a paramilitary force. Now, they certainly did not want to necessarily defend the socialist government, but they wanted to defeat the communist movement. So in 1920, there was a big battle in the Ruhr between the communists and the right-wing Free Corps, and Niemöller led one of those battalions, defeating the communists in this battle. So he was really on the far right at this time. These paramilitary groups known as the Free Corps were in many ways precursors to the Nazis in terms of their politics and in terms of their militarism. So even though the Nazis had not really gotten their movement going by this point, joining a Free Corps was a sure sign of where you stood politically.
And he joined them. Did he fight with them?
Well, he never actually officially joins any particular Free Corps, but he does fight with them in the Battle of the Ruhr. I mean, he was getting married. He had gotten married recently. I think a child was on the way. And I don't think he felt that joining the Free Corps and sort of in a full-time basis was what sort of a husband and a father could do. But he certainly demonstrated his support for them on a couple different occasions.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Matthew D. Hockness. He is a professor of history at Skidmore College and author of the book, Then They Came for Me, Martin Niemöller, the Pastor Who Defied the Nazis. Before he defied the Nazis, Martin Niemöller was a supporter of the Nazis. Tell me about his relationship to the Nazi Party.
Well, we know that in 1924 came after a horrible period in Weimar history, because of the Versailles Treaty and the reparations that Germany had to pay and Germany's reluctance to pay them. There was great inflation in Germany in the early 1920s. It went from inflation to hyperinflation, where you know a dollar was worth something like 3 trillion marks or something. So everybody's savings was burned up, and it really felt like this new government was just a complete and total political and economic disaster. And so when elections took place in 1924, Niemöller voted for the Nazis. He was also ordained a Lutheran pastor in 1924 because he had resigned from the Navy in 1919 because he didn't want to serve the new government. And he started going to the University of Munster for divinity school. And so for 3 years, he studied theology. And then in 1924, he was ordained a Lutheran minister. That same year, he votes for the Nazis. And he continued to have this sort of right-wing political agenda for the remainder of the Weimar period. He never gave up his hatred of the Weimar Republic. And he's given his first pastorate, his first congregation in 1931. And so during this period from 1923-24 until 1931, he served as sort of the director of the Westphalian Intermission, which is a sort of a welfare institution within the Protestant Church. And during that period, he would often engage in various political meetings and things like that, not necessarily with the Nazis, but with right-wing nationalists. When the Nazis come to power in January 1933, they hold elections in March 1933, and he votes for them again. And I think that vote is even a more damning vote, because at this point, it's quite clear what the Nazis stand for. In 1924, people knew what they stood for, but of course, Hitler had not yet written Mein Kampf, and there could be some confusion or at least some misunderstanding. But by 1933, when Niemöller votes for them the second time, he had already read Mein Kampf. He was reading Mein Kampf, I think, in 30 or 31. And so he knew exactly what the Nazis stood for when he voted for them the second time.
Well, what was the Nazis' relationship and view of the church, and maybe in particular the Lutheran church?
Well, the Nazis, when they came to power, at least, Hitler promised to work with the churches to establish a conservative Protestant Germany. Now, he needed to do that in part because he came to power very much with the support of conservatives in Germany. And he needed to maintain their support. He couldn't just simply have the support of the more radical Nazis. And so conservatives in business, in the churches, in agriculture, the Junkers, the Prussian Junkers, and in other conservative institutions were very important in bringing the Nazis to power. So when he at first comes to power and announces that he's going to work with the churches, this is really an important moment because it allowed a lot of Protestants like Niemöller and Catholics as well to say, well, if Hitler's going to protect the churches from the far left, because the other two strongest parties in 1933 or leading up to that were the Nazis on the one hand and the socialists and communists on the other. So given the choice between socialism or communism and Nazism, a lot of conservatives chose Nazism. So the Nazis, though, have a much more complicated sort of relationship to churches and religion, because ultimately Hitler wanted to get rid of all churches, that he saw them as an alternative authority in Germany, and he did not want any alternative authorities. He wanted to be the only authority. So his long-term plans for the churches was to get rid of them. But and since he had come to power with something like 35% of the vote, he didn't want to ostracize Protestants or Catholics.
They also got involved in how the church would operate. I think we call them German Christians and trying to Arianize, if that would be the correct way of saying it, the Bible.
Yeah, so I think that this is an important point. Although Hitler talked about working with and protecting the conservative Protestant church, he was also a supporter of this movement that you just described, the German Christian movement. The German Christians were kind of new on the scene. In 1932, they began to form a movement, and their entire sort of notion of what the churches should look like was a fusion of Nazism or National Socialism and Protestantism. And so needless to say, as this movement developed, Hitler found it to his liking. The conservative Protestant leaders, however, were perfectly happy to work with the Nazis, but they were not pleased that the German Christians were making efforts to take over leadership positions in the church. So the support that Hitler eventually shows for the German Christians in many ways is the beginning of Martin Niemöller's break with Nazism. He supported Hitler's foreign policy for the most part. He supported Hitler's racial policy, lots of Hitler's domestic policies. But what he found most problematic was Hitler's church policy, which was to support the German Christians against the established conservative Protestants that Niemöller identified with. Niemöller liked Nazi politics, but he didn't like Nazi church politics.
Is my understanding correct that the German Christians and the German Christian movement was trying to put perhaps even more emphasis on a figure like Martin Luther, who was German himself, than Jesus Christ?
Yeah, the German Christians wanted to remove any aspects of Judaism or Jewish life from the church. And so they even went so far as to try to Arianize Jesus, to deny his Jewish origins. They tried to eliminate the Old Testament from the Protestant church. And they wanted to also ban any Christians from the church who had Jewish heritage. And so these Christians of Jewish descent, there were many in Germany, and many of them were loyal and dedicated followers of the Protestant church. And obviously, if you're a Nazi, you don't want any quote-unquote Jewish blood in the church, and so they wanted to try to ban them. And they tried to pass legislation that was called the Aryan Paragraph. The Aryan Paragraph would have removed any Protestant pastors or employees of the church who were of Jewish origin. Niemöller didn't support this because, at least within the Protestant church, he remained committed to sort of the conservative establishment. And so really the origins of Niemöller's opposition to Nazism had to do with the German Christians, their attempt to alter the creed of the Protestant church, and trying to establish racial criteria for entry into the church were the things that he and other established conservatives found offensive. And this was really the beginning of the opposition or the defiance that Niemöller showed to Hitler and the Nazis.
How did he defy Hitler and the Nazis over this?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, he has this reputation as a hero of the resistance, but his resistance was limited. It was sort of single issue dissent towards Hitler's church policy. He, more than anything else, was fighting the German Christian incursion into the church. The German, with Hitler's help, the German Christians were elected to leadership positions within the church in July of 1933. And this was really a major turning point for Niemöller and a lot of others in the established church, because they realized that Hitler was not simply allowing these church elections to go forward fair and square, but that he was actually out there on the campaign trail practically for the German Christians. And so it's sort of the first moment that they realize, Hitler is going to support this opportunistic group that is undermining, you know, the Protestantism that we grew up with and that we, you know, were ordained to preach from the pulpit. And so his opposition is primarily developing an opposition movement to the German Christians. And in September of 1933, he and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a young Lutheran theologian, and some other like-minded pastors founded the Pastors Emergency League. And the Pastors Emergency League had a four-part pledge that essentially stated that as ordained ministers, we are going to preach the gospel as we were taught to do, and we are not going to allow foreign influences like Nazism into the church. And we're also going to defend our co-pastors who have Jewish heritage or Jewish ancestry from attack by the German Christians and the Nazis. So the founding of PEL, or the Pastors Emergency League, is sort of a turning point in Niemöller's opposition, because from this point on, He is a leader of the Pastors Emergency League, which eventually will develop into the Confessing Church, and an ardent opponent of any attempts by the German Christians to influence the direction of the church.
You mentioned Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He would die in a concentration camp.
Yeah, so Dietrich Bonhoeffer dies in April 1945. He's killed by the Nazis 2 weeks before his concentration camp was liberated. And this, of course, was to try to eliminate any potential future leaders of a non-Nazi Germany. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer was born in 1906, and he's murdered by the Nazis in 1945, just weeks before he would have been liberated. He was of a very different mindset than Niemöller, although they joined together in the founding of Pell, and they're both major players in the Confessing Church. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was liberal, cosmopolitan, anti-Nazi on every possible position the Nazis took. He opposed Nazi foreign policy, Nazi domestic policy, Nazi racial policy. He came from a liberal family. His sister was married to a Christian of Jewish descent. His best friend, Franz Hildebrandt, was also a Christian of Jewish descent. And so he had a very different outlook than Niemöller. Niemöller remained nationalistic, conservative, and even a supporter of the Nazis on many levels. Here's a good example. In September of 1933, they found the Pastors Emergency League. In October 1933, Niemöller joins together with a lot of fellow pastors to send Hitler a telegram praising his withdrawal from the League of Nations and from the disarmament talks. Clearly, you know, Niemöller, by this action and the action of many other members of Pell who joined him in sending this telegram, are indicating their support for Nazism. And they actually believe that if Hitler truly understood what was going on in the church and he understood the difference between the German Christians and the conservative Protestant establishment, that he might even side with the conservative Protestants. They think that he's simply not understanding the situation, and it's one of the reasons why they can continue to support him, because they see him as just being misled by the leaders of the German Christians. A man by the name of Bishop Ludwig Müller was the leader of the German Christians, and he had frequent contact with Hitler. And for this reason, you know, the men who eventually would form the Confessing Church can still remain and feel comfortable calling themselves either Nazis or at least supporters of the government.
Well, you are leading me very nicely into my next question, Matthew Hockeness, because in your book, Then They Came for Me, Martin Niemöller, the pastor who defied the Nazis, your account of when Niemöller and some of these other pastors finally get to meet with Adolf Hitler, as Adolf Hitler is learning about their resistance to what the Nazis are trying to do, your account in the book of that meeting is just hair-raising.
Thank you. So Hitler was just both confused and irate at the church problem. The church problem was essentially that there was a struggle going on within the church between the conservative Protestant establishment and the German Christians. And Hitler, to a certain extent, couldn't fully understand what was going on. And he also felt that it was just a bad sign in Nazi Germany to have Protestants fighting it out. International news coverage was covering the church struggle in Germany, and it just seemed like bad press to Hitler. So he called for a meeting where some of the leaders of the conservative establishment would join the leader of the German Christians, Ludwig Müller, along with some Nazi leaders, and they would have a meeting to discuss the issues. The conservative Protestant establishment was ecstatic about this, as was Niemöller. I mean, they just couldn't believe how fortunate they were that they were going to get to meet with Hitler and explain what was really going on. So for weeks in advance of the meeting, they prepared and prepared, and the meeting was scheduled for January 25th, 1934. They were supposed to meet Hitler and his entourage at the Reich Chancellery, and they show up there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, thinking that this is going to be a big turning point for them, and Hitler greets them along with his some other government ministers, including Hermann Göring, who was there. And they walk in and they shake hands. And they're standing around in sort of a semicircle looking at one another. And Hitler glances over at Hermann Göring. And Göring pulls a piece of paper out of his briefcase and he reads the transcript of a phone conversation that Niemöller had had that morning with a fellow pastor. The fellow pastor had called to ask Niemöller how prepared they were for the meeting. And Niemöller was saying, we're all prepared. We know that Hindenburg, President Paul von Hindenburg, who is still alive, is going to meet with Hitler at noon. And then we're all going to meet with Hitler at one. And he sort of ends his conversation with this pastor by saying, and at the meeting with Hindenburg, the president is going to read the last rites to Hitler. And as Göring is reading the transcript of this conversation, everybody in the room is silent and kind of paralyzed by it.
Wow.
I mean, it was sort of the worst thing possible. First of all, you know, that Niemöller's phone had been tapped and that they had, you know, had the transcript from that morning's conversation, and that Niemöller had said something so sort of foolish. It was meant as a joke that since Hindenburg was kind of supportive of the church establishment and not the German Christians, the reading of Hitler, the last rites meant, I think, that he was basically going to tell Hitler how he should act in the church struggle by supporting the conservative establishment. So at the when Göring is finished reading the transcript, everyone's silent. Hitler asks Niemöller to step forward, and he does. And Niemöller, he's asked, did this in fact take place? And Niemöller says, yes, in fact, the conversation took place, as you've heard. But let me just explain to you that our, you know, the Pastors Emergency League and the conservatives in the church are not anti-state, and we certainly are not anti-Nazi. We simply want to return the Protestant church to its creed, to the Reformation confessions. And the German Christians are trying to bring foreign influences into the church, and that's where our opposition is. Our opposition is to these foreign influences into the church, not to the state and not to you.
And it's not long after this that he gets arrested, eventually ends up in a concentration camp. And this is a conversation I feel like we can actually go for 2 hours. Unfortunately, we only have 50 minutes, so I'm gonna speed us up a little bit here. Obviously, being held in a concentration camp where so many people are being murdered, he survived, is a transformative experience for better and for worse. What happens to him during this period of time that he's being held for, what is it, 8 years?
Yes. So from 1933, let's say late 1933 until 1937, Niemöller is really a thorn in the side of the Nazis. He's constantly doing battle with the German Christians over theology and the politics of the church and what the correct direction of the church is. He's giving sermons that are considered inflammatory, and he is more and more becoming sort of an agent of church resistance. In 1936, he and some fellow pastors in the Confessing Church send Hitler a confidential memorandum where they say some pretty strong language. They demand that the Nazis and the German Christians stop trying to deconfessionalize or de-Christianize Germany. And they even have some language in the statement where they call into question Nazi anti-Semitism. So there are a number of things that Niemöller is doing that Hitler is not happy with. And so on July 1st, 1937, the Gestapo arrived at Niemöller's house. They'd been there before. They'd interrogated him before at Alexanderplatz in Berlin. He'd been retired by the leaders of the German Christians. He had been suspended. And throughout all of this, he continued to preach in defiance of these suspensions. And by the time he's arrested on July 1st, 1937, it has just become too much for the Nazi leadership to allow him to continue to preach as he is. In fact, in one of his last sermons in 1937, he challenges Hitler on whether or not he is an honest person or not. He asks in his sermon, you know, is Hitler trustworthy? And he answers the question in front of his congregation, no, he's not trustworthy, because he said he was going to protect and work with the churches in 1933, and he hasn't. So a few weeks after that particular sermon, he's arrested. The understanding is that at first, at least, that he's just going to go and have a 2-hour or so interrogation with the Gestapo at Alexanderplatz. But instead, he's taken to Moabit prison, which is in Berlin, and he's charged with, among some other things, misusing the pulpit for political reasons. And for 8 months, he is held in Moabit prison, where he is planning his, where he's planning the defense of his trial. And meanwhile, the court system is gathering evidence against him. The trial finally takes place in February 1937. And to make a long story short, he's found guilty of misusing the pulpit for political reasons, but he's sentenced to 7 months. And since he was already in prison for 8 months, they agreed that he had served his time and that he could be released. Hitler was irate about this decision by the court. He couldn't believe that the court could be so incompetent to let Niemöller go. And so he orders that Niemöller be arrested as Hitler's personal prisoner, and he's taken to Sachsenhausen concentration camp just outside Berlin, and he's held there until 1941.
And then after that, he goes to Dachau concentration camp, which is near Munich, which I think was one of the first, maybe the first concentration camp.
Yeah, Dachau started operations in the spring of 1933, and it's at Dachau where a lot of those early arrestees were taken, socialist, communist.
That's where the political arrests, the people who were arrested for political reasons were taken. Yeah. Let me jump us forward here, because I've left so little time for the actual transformation, but this entire life is fascinating of Martin Niemöller. And so far, we've gotten through halfway of his life. As you indicated, he would live well into his 90s. I'm going to fast forward us through his time in the concentration camp. After that, when we come out with this saying that we know about, you know, first they came for the communists, and they came for the trade unionists, and they came for the Jews, and they came for me, and no one was left to speak out for me. Was he a transformed person in the second half of his life? Could we even say he was a man of the left?
Well, let me, yes, eventually I would say yes. I just would point out that during his time in the concentration camps from 1938 until 1945, he was never tortured or hurt. He suffered, of course, because he was often in solitary confinement in Sachsenhausen and Dachau. He was housed with other priests and pastors, so his life in Dachau was better than in Sachsenhausen. But it's interesting that in 1939, when the war broke out, he volunteered to serve in the German armed forces and to fight in Hitler's armies against Russia and the other powers. So his nationalism and his kind of right-wing politics were still a part of who he was as late as 1939. When he gets out of the concentration camp in 1945, he's interviewed in a famous interview where he repeats a lot of this stuff, you know, nonsense about, you know, that the Nazis had meant to do well, but that he had been misled by them, that no one in Germany, you know, knew about concentration or extermination camps, and a lot of other sort of right-wing rhetoric. So he did not come out of the concentration camps a transformed or changed person, although I think that that was the start of it. Over time, Niemöller does become a pacifist. He declares his pacifism in 1954. He is a supporter of many left-wing movements. He becomes a sort of central figure in the ecumenical movement, trying to bring together various denominations worldwide. And so I have no question, really, that his transformation or evolution morally and politically is genuine. But I will say that it took much longer than perhaps people think. It didn't happen in the concentration camps. It didn't happen in 1945. It took place over maybe a 20-year period from the time he's arrested until the early 1950s. And probably a couple of the most important motivations for him making this evolution would be his realization that the Nazis were persecuting the churches, his arrest by Hitler and being held in the concentration camp for 8 years, his the exposure of the horrors of the Holocaust certainly played a role as well. Coming out of the concentration camp in 45, you know, the news media was flooded at this time with images of the extermination, concentration camps, and piles of bodies. And so that obviously affected Niemöller as well. He was also in contact with a lot of foreign Protestants at this time, people like Karl Barth from Switzerland, American Protestants who were interested in making contact with him. And they all had an influence on him as well, trying to, you know, nudge him away from German national Protestantism towards a more international ecumenical Protestantism.
As he changed, he said if he had lived even any longer than he already had, he probably would have become an anarchist.
Yeah. Well, he never, in my opinion, became a communist to begin with. I think that he thought that keeping the dialogue open between the East and the West during the Cold War was really important. And since West Germany was filled with a lot of Cold War hawks, just like in the United States, he showed greater interest in meeting with Russians and other East Europeans and trying to keep a dialogue going between the two sides. For that reason, he has often been accused of communism, but I think that's probably going a little too far. Of course, some signs that he had moved to the left was, you know, in 1965, he goes to Vietnam. Again, he returns in 1967, this time to North Vietnam, where he actually has a sit-down meeting with Ho Chi Minh, who he praises as a great man and a moral leader. In the late 1960s or early 1970s, he's awarded the Lenin Prize by the Soviet Union, and he vacations in the Soviet Union after receiving the prize. So there are lots of signs that he is at least less critical of communism than he should have been or might have been, whereas he is a very outspoken critic of the West during this period and Western imperialism in particular.
Matthew Huckiness, this was fascinating. I always knew, I shouldn't say always, but before now, I knew about the history of the rise of fascism in Germany and how chaotic it was and the battles between the left and the right in the streets. I knew about the words from Martin Niemöller that most people know today about first they came for the communists and so on and so on. But I never knew how these stories came together. So that was fascinating. I thank you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Again, the name of the book, Then They Came For Me, Martin Niemöller, The Pastor Who Defied the Nazis. Our guest was Matthew D. Huckiness. And that does it for Letters and Politics. The show is produced by Deanna Martinez. Kristen Thomas is our engineer. You can find archives of our previous shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I thank you for listening.
KPFA members, it's once again time for your local station board election. Your local station board members represent you, the KPFA listeners, and help determine the direction of the station. The nomination period is open until October 24th, and you can get a candidate application package by visiting kpfa.org. There are currently 9 vacant listener seats and 3 staff member vacancies. Visit kpfa.org for more details and to nominate yourself, another member, or your favorite KPFA staff member. Stay tuned for other ways to participate in the 2018 Local Station Board, which will be held November 15th through December 20th, 2018.
KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org.
From the KPFK studios in Southern California,
it's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour.
Stand up, stand up.